The Majority Report with Sam Cedar, where every day's casual Friday. That means Monday is casual Monday, Tuesday, casual Tuesday, Wednesday, casual hump day, Thursday, casual Thurs, that's what we call it, and Friday, casual Shabbat. The Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Friday, February 15th, 2019. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live steps from the industrially ravaged Gowanus Canal in the heartland of America, downtown Brooklyn, USA. On the program today, gonna break a little bit of the usual casual Friday format. Just did an interview with Eric Alterman of, well, many different publications. The Nation magazine on Elliot Abrams. We will talk about that. Then later in the program, Isabel Gillies, best-selling author, will be with us to talk about her latest, which is a little bit Marie Kondo, a little bit. Also on the program today, supposedly the budget deal is about to be signed by Donald Trump. ICE will grow under this deal. And the Republicans have successfully blocked back payments for almost 2 million federal contractors who got screwed in the government shutdown. Meanwhile, desperate for a win, Donald Trump will call a national state of emergency, supposedly, to build, supposedly, a supposed wall. There will be some good that comes out of this if it, aside from just the enormous, lengthy legal scramblings that will go on for years. Meanwhile, Amazon has broken the hearts of developers looking to drive middle class and folks in poverty from Queens.
So celebrate good times. Come on.
Meanwhile, I apparently bigfooted Bill Weld from the Libertarian primary.
Whoa.
And now he's going to challenge Donald Trump in the Republican primary.
Well, it's just sitting there in a law office in Midtown like, I don't want to deal with the road hypothetical.
or seatbelts.
He'd rather deal with Trump's hilarious nicknames.
Senate Republicans confirm William Barr. Arkansas makes it five. They've now passed a law joining four other states anticipating the reversal of Roe v. Wade. Democrats announce their debate criteria. And Donald Trump has a sweet-ass golf simulator installed in the White House.
Executive time.
Executive time. All this and more on today's program. Folks, we've got a lot of stuff to get to today. It's going to be a somewhat abbreviated show because I am going to the wedding of producer emeritus of the Majority Report, Josh Horton. Is getting married. So it's very exciting. And I'm heading to Madison, Wisconsin. I may, in fact, do a tour of the Just Coffee facilities there in Madison. I think it's supposed to be maybe almost in double digits, the temperature. So that shall be fun. That should be fun. But I've got to catch a plane. So we've got to move rather quickly. However, we must not ignore this. Alex Jones apparently is still doing a program, and I imagine he's doing quite well with it. However, he is losing legal battle after legal battle with the some of the parents from Sandy Hook. They already have access to, I think, some of his financial records, right? And they just won access to one other sort of like information on the inside to this is a way to determine, you know, what some of their his defamatory practices. But meanwhile, apparently he's very mad at Joe Rogan. And we're getting a lot of...
Wait, can I ask? Because we did this the other day on TMBS, and I think we should do this here too. I mean, maybe we should play it first, but I mean, just generally speaking, like whose side are we on here?
I am on the side of the American public, which I enjoy
very,
this quite
very
a bit.
Very libertarian candidate mode.
That's right.
There, buddy.
I'm on the side of the American public. Well, I'm enjoying it, so I don't know that I'm on either of their sides, frankly.
All right, very political answer. I'm backing Alex Jones on this one because he's fun.
Because he's fun.
Yes.
I mean, I
like Rogan too, of course.
I'm glad there's a fight.
And so, people know Jones is bad.
Yeah, they don't. Right.
The thing is, I don't think Alex Jones is going to point out the things that are problematic with Joe Rogan.
Well, he has a clip of him saying pretty racist.
Wait, what is that clip? I didn't see that clip. Was this an old clip?
Yeah, it's an old.
Joe Rogan still has hair in it, so it's a pretty old clip. But
Alex Jones just doing.
But early in his show, and what was it? What was he saying?
Media matters.
Joe Rogan appeared to be going on some sort of rant, riff about how he went to a movie theater in a largely black community, and he called it Planet of the Apes movie theater.
He went to see Planet of the Apes, right? Oh. And then he said it was like Planet of the Apes because there were no white people there, which is like pretty hard to misconstrue.
Yeah.
You know, it's one thing to have a certain sense of humor, not be dictated by PC culture, but we also need to draw certain lines on basic humanity.
Right, exactly.
InfoWars, Media Matter.
Alex Jones, not necessarily the best messenger for this, but here it is, nevertheless. And my understanding is Alex Jones got mad because the guy from Twitter was on Joe Rogan's, Jack Dorsey.
Jack Dorsey.
And Joe Rogan didn't know enough of why Alex Jones got kicked off of Twitter.
Rogan let Dorsey skate on the idea. He asked him why Alex Jones was kicked off of Twitter, and Jack Dorsey said, "I'm not really familiar with the details," and that's what upset Alex Jones.
He is a notoriously softball interviewer.
Let's hear. Yeah. So this is. Let's hear Alex Jones.
And it's just not going to happen. I'm built for war, Joe. Yeah, I don't act like a tough guy all day. I do the war. You understand?
So do the war.
So the threats don't matter to me. I'll still be your friend, Joe. I'll never talk to you again. I'll never come on your show again. I'm going to destroy you. I understand it now. I'm going to get you.
What?
I'm coming for you. You understand that? Who do you think I am? What do you think I do? You're very foolish.
Pause it for 1 second. Who does Alex Jones think he is? What does Alex Jones think he does?
I am Batman.
I'm Hulk Hogan Batman.
I'm trying to expand body positivity by introducing the notion that someone with my physical type can pay the Clape Crusader. All right. Excuse me. I'm having an asthma attack.
This is completely... impromptu.
Completely impromptu. The amphetamine supplements I'm taking are actually causing an acute pain in my abdomen.
But what is it that Alex Jones thinks I'm curious, like, if Joe Rogan doesn't know who Alex Jones is and what he does.
I think Jones gets into his credibility, the credibility of these threats.
Oh, okay. All right, let's listen. I want to see.
He's an info warrior, okay?
You've got to let him spell things out.
So, you've chosen your bed. Sleep in it. Don't give me any more pleasantries. I want war.
Should be lying it.
Give me your attacks. Everything.
Should be lying. Lie in your bed.
Now you understand the shape of things. That's good that you understand those. Now you understand. I'll get my hands politically around your neck.
Pause it. I love how careful he has to be now. Right? Like
that's
he's being
a very
sued.
Sound legal advice.
I am completely out of control, but I will politically... I'm speaking in metaphors now, explicitly, because so that there's no litigation opportunities here.
We'll destroy
politically
it,
around
you.
Your neck.
Metaphorically, I'm going to strangle you from a metaphorical standpoint, not like of a political way. Go ahead.
on your neck, and all your tough guy crap's going to end real quick. Quick. Because we've taken down Hillary, and we've taken down the globalist, and we're going to take down Soros, and we're going to take you down. Positive. Because God...
Nevertheless, I still can't quite figure out which camera we're on here. Okay, go ahead.
Down. Because God wants purity. God wants things hot and cold, not lukewarm. God wants me to wage war. God told me, destroy Joe Rogan. Yes, sir, Jesus, I will do it. No more games. War. Ah! The real thing.
Not the real. How long until political commentary shows just merge with pro wrestling?
Well, I think this already happened.
He's frankly ahead of the curve on that.
I love the idea that God is like,
Joe Rogan. Yeah, that's what we got to do. I've been looking at the podcast rankings on iTunes, yeah. And I think it's time. I want you to destroy
that
Joe
guy's
Rogan.
Getting a little too comfortable. There's another part which is awesome where he's like, "Oh, you're a tough guy." And I know, you know, the UFC was owned by the mafia. I already knew that.
I know everything you know.
I already knew that.
You're not telling me nothing I don't know. God spoke to me.
It's amazing that Joe Rogan has jumped to the top of the list above the globalist.
Well, the reason is because
he is a globalist.
It's because Joe Rogan is to Alex Jones what Pod Save America is to this show.
That's right. That's exactly right. And I also love the part where like Rogan literally has to say, he's just like, it's not helping that you're making stuff up, dude. I'm not a CIA agent.
let me just take this opportunity to go like, Pod Save America. Coming for you.
We have been told to destroy you. Politically.
Politically, we're going to crush you. Politically.
And I know you worked for Obama. He's connected with the financiers. We already knew that.
Did Barack Obama ask Citigroup if you guys should be put together for a podcast? Because we will crush you. Politically. Metaphorically speaking.
You ask Christian Gillibrand the tough question as a diversion because you're selling out Medicare for all. We already know the script.
We know the script. It was written a long time ago.
When the time comes, we will make no excuses for the terror politically.
I'm going to bury your watered down Green New Deal 6 feet under in the discourse.
Politically, yeah.
The total lack of God told me to go after you.
My absolute non-lack of belief in a greater deity is directing me to destroy you.
Secular humanist ideas told me to go after you.
All right. Let's move on.
Favreau's like, guys, you're not helping us get single payer.
All right. Let's move on here. I specifically told Michael yesterday he can't play this clip because Elliot Abrams has been one of those zombie horrible figures that I have been disgusted with since probably when Michael was literally in diapers. And in fact, I think,
actually potentially not even born yet.
We're going to get to Eric Alterman, interview in just a couple of minutes where I do think like the first thing I probably ever read of Eric Alterman's was probably my senior year in college, reading about Elliot Abrams, back when he had hair and, a similar sort of like, disposition. But here is Ilhan Omar, and she, people have heard this, but it, and you know, some people are taking a little bit of exception with some of the her, what they perceive as her not knowing the full story behind this. But the fact of the matter is the reason why we are talking about this is because she showed the courage to bring it up. There are some people who are out there accusing her of not knowing the details and frankly don't know the details themselves. She uses the language of genocide. specifically the words genocide. That is, and we'll talk to Eric Altman about this, but that, understand, that is a direct quote from a UN overseen Guatemalan Reconciliation Commission. That is a direct quote. The word genocide is a direct quote that she lifted from there. So, and we will get to more of the details with Eric Altman, but let's listen to her questioning of Elliot Abrams, and we'll go through some of Elliot Abrams' greatest hits.
Thank you. Ms. Omar.
Thank you, Chairman. Thank you all for being here, and thank you for your testimonies. Mr. Adams, in 1991, you pleaded guilty to two counts of withholding information from Congress regarding your involvement in the Iran-Contra affair.
Now, pause it for a second. So she says Adams instead of Abrams, right? I mean, she clearly knows who she's talking to. She missays the name. To get caught up on something like that is stunning. It's incomprehensible to me that that's where you would focus your attention on this. But that is, you know, it's
got her.
I think it's effing cool, man. I mean, you do that all the time, right?
Well, yes.
Just to throw shade on people.
I don't know
it's
that.
Power move.
I don't think she did that to throw shade. I think that, you know, she's, I don't know if English is her second or third language. She speaks it better than the president, who ostensibly it's the first. But go ahead.
Contra affair, for which you were later pardoned by President George H.W. Bush. I fail to understand why members of this committee or the American people should find any testimony that you give today to be truthful.
If I can respond to that.
It wasn't a question.
I reserve the right to my time. It is not right.
That was not a question.
Committee can attack
on February 8th.
Who is not permitted to reply?
That was not a question. Thank you for your participation. On February 8th, 1982, you testified before the Senate Foreign Relations Committee about U.S. policy in El Salvador. In that hearing, you dismissed as communist propaganda report about the massacre of El Mozote, in which more than 800 civilians, including children as young as 2 years old, were brutally murdered by U.S.-trained troops. During that massacre, some of those troops bragged about raping a 12-year-old girl before they killed them. Girls before they killed them. You later said that the U.S. policy in El Salvador was a fabulous achievement. Yes or no, do you still think so?
From the day that President Duarte was elected in a free election to this day, El Salvador has been a democracy. That's a fabulous achievement.
Yes or no, do you think that massacre was a fabulous achievement that happened under our watch?
That is a ridiculous question, and I
yes
will not
or no.
No.
I will take that as a yes.
I am not going to respond to that kind of personal attack, which is not a question.
Pause it.
Yes.
There has not been a single personal attack there than other than a recitation of well-established facts. Well-established facts. Continue.
Kind of personal attack, which is not a question.
Yes or no, would you support an armed faction within Venezuela that engages in war crimes, crimes against humanity or genocide, if you believe they were serving U.S. interest, as you did in Guatemala, El Salvador, and Nicaragua? Yep.
I am not going to respond to that question. I'm sorry. I don't think this entire line of questioning is meant to be real questions, and so I will not reply.
Whether you, under your watch, a genocide will take place, and you will look the other way because American interests were being upheld, is a fair question, because the American people want to know that anytime we engage a country, that we think about what our actions could be and how we believe our values are being furthered.
Pause.
That is my.
She is specifically referring to the fact that he did exactly what she's asking him if he would do in Venezuela. He did exactly that in Guatemala. And those findings are not her findings. Those findings are not a columnist's findings. Those are the findings of a UN-sanctioned Guatemalan Reconciliation Committee, which ultimately imprisoned the dictator, the general, that he supported. Go.
That is my question. Will you make sure that human rights are not violated and that we uphold international and human rights?
I suppose there is a question in there, and the answer is that the entire thrust of American policy in Venezuela is to support the Venezuelan people's effort to restore democracy to their country. That's our policy.
I don't think anybody disputes that. The question I had for you is that does the interest of the United States include protecting human rights and include protecting people against genocide?
That is always the position of the United States.
Thank you. I yield back my time.
Yeah, I mean, it's absurd. It's absurd. And here he is. He's back again. This is a guy who obviously has lied to Congress before. So he was unable to be confirmed during the Bush years. We talk about this with Eric Alterman. I should also say that what we didn't get into the interview with Alterman, although briefly, was Elliot Abrams was responsible for two things under the Bush administration. One, he was responsible for selling to Christian Zionists in this country why the Bush administration should essentially push for the unilateral exit of Israel from the Gaza Strip. And the idea being was that the Bush administration thought that this would empower Fatah. When it didn't, when it empowered Hamas, they basically encouraged a civil war there amongst the Palestinians. Elliot Abrams was deeply involved in this. And it turned into quite a mess. And you see, I mean, we're looking at Israel now almost 16, 17 years later. And it's become even more of a disaster, I think, in terms of their policy. But let's take a quick break. When we come back, Eric Alterman. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome back to this program the distinguished professor of English and journalism at Brooklyn College, City University of New York, author of 10 books, including the New York Times bestseller, What Liberal Media? The Truth About Bias in the News, Eric Alterman. Eric, welcome back to the program.
Thank you.
I think, Eric, that I probably first read you. It's quite possible, it seems to me, that I first read you maybe just as I was leaving college or a senior in college about Elliot Abrams 25 some odd years ago.
Well, it's an honor to be considered part of your education, Sam.
Well,
yeah, I wrote about Elliot Abrams. I guess I wouldn't say I'm obsessed with Elliot Abrams, but I sort of am. I was at one time, it's fair to say, back in 1986, 87, I began writing about him. And then when he was running El Salvador and Nicaragua and Guatemala, I guess you could call that Central America, policy in the State Department under Ronald Reagan. And then he became briefly famous, or rather infamous, because of Iran-Contra and his having lied to Congress and on television. And then it disappeared for a while, showed up again under the Bush administration, the second Bush administration, where he helped undermine the Palestinian elections on the National Security Council. He was put on the National Security Council because it was understood that he would never be confirmed by the Senate, having been convicted of perjuring himself before Congress. And then, briefly, he was expected to be named the number two person in the State Department in the Trump administration. He was chosen for that job, and he was lobbied for by Sheldon Adelson, who usually gets what he wants from the Trump administration, and Jared Kushner. But he was vetoed by Steve Bannon for being a globalist. In this case, that doesn't mean Jew, although it helps. But now he's back for the umpteenth time, like an undead zombie, being put in charge of Venezuela policy by our current Secretary of State, Mike Pompeo.
I want to start with his most egregious things that we know of anyways. And then, you know, and you've just laid out sort of like the times he's reared his head. I think the most egregious was his work in Guatemala, if I'm not mistaken, right? In terms of supporting what ultimately was deemed by a UN sanctioned or overseen reconciliation commission in Guatemala as being a genocide. Tell us about that.
I brought up some notes. I can just read you something I've written that hasn't been published yet. It's going to be published in Le Monde Diplomatique in a few weeks, where I went through the main points of Elliot's guilt with regard to Guatemala, El Salvador, Nicaragua, Panama, and then later the Palestinian issue. Do you mind if I read this, or do you want me to?
No, please. By all means.
Okay. Guatemalan General Efrain Rios Montt led a coup in March 1982. Abrams, then Assistant Secretary of State for Human Rights, soon credited him with, quote, considerable progress on human rights issues and insisted that, quote, the amount of killing innocent civilians is being reduced step by step. That's a quote from Elliott. In fact, according to a declassified document, the State Department had already received what it called well-founded allegations of large-scale killing of Indian men, women, and children in a remote area by the Guatemalan army. Even so, Abrams demanded that Congress provide the regime with advanced arms because, quote, progress needed to be rewarded and encouraged. In 2013, however, Rios Montt was convicted by the Guatemalan UN-backed Commission for Historical Clarification of committing acts of genocide, that's a quote, but against the indigenous people of the Ixtl region in the Department of Quiché, I think it's pronounced.
Mm.
So while he was defending this regime, it was committing what is now legally determined to be genocide. I'm going to go on. We're still in Guatemala. Promoted to Assistant Secretary of State for Inter-American Affairs, Abrams repeatedly denounced organizations protesting the mass murders perpetrated by Rios Montt and his successor, Oscar Meja Victoris and Vincenzo Cerezo Arevalo. In April 1985, Maria Rosario Godoy de Cuevas, a leader of the Guatemalan Mutual Support Group, an organization of mothers of the disappeared, was found dead and her brother and three-year-old son, with her brother and three-year-old son in their wrecked car. Abrams not only supported the government's scarcely credible claim that the deaths had been an accident, but also brought legal action against those asking for an investigation. A New York Times op-ed challenged the official State Department account of the mass murders. It was written by a woman who had witnessed a death squad-style assassination in broad daylight in Guatemala City, which had not been mentioned in the press. Abrams wrote a letter to the editor in a barefaced lie. He cited an imaginary story in a non-existent newspaper to prove the assassination had been reported. Guatemala.
In my understanding, at one point too, there was a situation where the general had overseen the bringing in of these indigenous people into a, I think it was a church, and literally slaughtered them and slaughtered all the men by decapitation, and then proceeded to rape all the women. And the, I mean, this is something that Abrams must have been aware of, right? I mean, there's no way that he wasn't aware of this.
Well, he, you know, he didn't want to believe it. I'm sure he had reports of it, and he chose to ignore them or disbelieve them.
And so,
as we know, the State Department was getting reports on this. Yeah,
right. And so, there were similar, maybe not as explicitly established dynamic throughout Central America, El Salvador. We're talking, and then he was.
Yeah, there's a famous case that was brought up by Representative Omar, although she didn't really appear to know what she was talking about, but she didn't get the facts wrong. When there was this famous massacre in a place called El Mizote, very early in Reagan's efforts to try and support the regime there, it was reported in the New York Times and the Washington Post, and it was a vicious effort by the Reagan administration and its supporters, particularly the Wall Street Journal, to try and undermine those reports because they worried that it would. People were still sensitive about Vietnam, and they were worried that reports of a massacre, as it had done in My Lai in Vietnam, would undermine their ability to fight a proxy war there. And again, Abrams insisted that the reports were not, quote-unquote, not credible to a Senate committee, and it appears that the incident is at least being significantly misused at best by the guerrillas. So he was saying that the Times and the Post were the puppets of the communist guerrillas there. In fact, this another truth commission, this one in El Salvador, found 5,000 civilians were deliberately and systematically murdered in that place. Most were women and children. Many were raped. You know, you can't imagine a more horrific scene. It's a shame that Representative Omar wasn't more familiar with the facts, because Elliot got all huffy and said he was being maligned, but it's a matter of fact, and a calm disquisition of them, as I've just given you, would have nailed his ass. But
yeah, I guess. I mean, but at the same time, the reason why we're talking about this and that has come
right.
through.
No, that's been the value of it.
And
I'm
certainly
glad he did it.
Absolutely.
I just wish someone else on the committee had followed up.
Well, it would have been nice, but they probably knew even less. Frankly, I mean, let's be honest. I mean, this is not the idea, and I don't want to jump ahead of ourselves because I want to talk about this dynamic where this guy does not seem like, you know, it's one thing to question why he hasn't been tried, you know, like along with the many other, you know, sort of arguable, and I think you know Elliot Abrams is on one end of the spectrum of the arguable. War criminals that we have had over the years in terms of our our foreign policy apparatus. But the idea that he's going up there and he's not going to be challenged on anything. I mean, the guy's lied to Congress, right? Like, he's a proven liar to Congress. And
lying to Congress is pretty minor compared to the engendering of genocide, I would say.
I agree.
I would say
but he's
that
not been called to account for any of it. And so he comes back.
There's two really disturbing things about Abrams' presence in our political discourse, I think. One is that he was chosen by the Secretary of State Tillerson to be the number two man in the State Department, and this was treated in the press as an example of a responsible Republican.
Yes.
Yeah, he lied to Congress, but he's not one of these Trump crazies. And second, in this case, Abrams is being vigorously defended by people like William Burns, who was the number two person in the State Department under Obama, and Max Boot, who is a leader of the Never Trumpers, again, a neocon and a member of good standing in the resistance. And his role in the genocide is being ignored. Now, there are other people you could accuse of engendering genocide. Henry Kissinger being the most obvious. I suppose Dick Cheney as well. But we don't have legal grounds for it in any of those cases. We've got legal decisions here, particularly by the Guatemalan Truth Commission. Elliott was the responsible officer in the State Department at the time, and he's on record, and yet no one cares. And this has been well covered. I know this stuff in part because I read it in the New York Times when it happened. And so, yes, the lesson from this is you can commit genocide, or you can help commit genocide, you can engender genocide as a government official in the United States and be treated perfectly honorably by the press, by the Council on Foreign Relations, by the Jewish establishment, where Elliott's a very popular speaker among synagogues. He's quoted almost every day on a website that sends me a news push every day, Jewish Insider. So long as you have the right patrons, so long as you've made the right friends, so long as you go to the right cocktail parties, Elliott is on record saying some of the worst things I've ever heard an American official say and participating in them. And he did it, he did it as an apparatchik. He wasn't a grand strategist the way Kissinger was, or vice president and secretary of defense the way Cheney was. He was just some punk doing this because it advanced his career, and he didn't care in the slightest bit about the moral impact of it, which it turns out is genocide. Just like genocide was committed against the Jews, just like genocide was committed against the Cambodians, just like genocide was committed in Africa. We all talk about how, we have museums, we have conferences, we have poems, we have prayers, and yet here's a guy who's in part responsible for it, and we have no problem with him. So it exposes the hypocrisy of the American foreign policy establishment and the Jewish establishment to a degree like nothing else does. I've tried to write that article about the moral vacuum at the center of these institutions, and I haven't been able to do it. I can do it in The Nation.
Right.
I mean, I've done it 6 times in The Nation, but I've wanted to do it in mainstream publications and in Jewish publications, and it turns out to be impossible.
What is, I'm looking at like a series of tweets, ranging from, like you said, Nicholas Burns to the Center for American Progress's National Security VP.
That one was taken down.
That was
for the record.
That
was deleted.
Okay,
yeah.
So the public proclamation has been removed, but the sentiment, I imagine, remains.
Very well said, Samuel.
What accounts for this durability? We saw
it's
this.
It's a club. It's a club. The only time the Council on Foreign Relations has rebuked Abrams was when he called Chuck. Secretary of Defense.
Right. Chuck, yes, I can't even remember his name now, but he was Secretary of Defense under Obama.
Right,
Hagel,
Abrams called him an anti-Semite. Chuck Hagel, right. And Abrams called him an anti-Semite in order to oppose him because he was considered to be unsympathetic to Israel. And then the head of the Council on Foreign Relations, Richard Haass, said, we're not really comfortable with this, that he's gone too far.
All right. Well, we could go over to the period where he was brought in to
including genocide. But if you attack people who are also in the club, that's not cool. There's that famous story of Larry Summers telling Elizabeth Warren that her ideas are fine. They can debate them, support them, or disagree with them. But when you start attacking people who are with us, then we can't deal with you. And so that's what Abrams did, and that's what he was rebuked for that one time. I guess he didn't understand that Chuck Hagel was also considered a member of the club, having been a senator. But anything else you do, it's not. As long as you're in the club, people are going to protect you. And if you start attacking people like this, then you're going to be out of the club. I mean, there have been people who have been in this club who have been run out of it because their criticism became two-pointed.
Are we just left with that? It's stunning, and in many ways, it seems to me, to the extent that we have a vacuum of a genuine left foreign policy, right? One where the whether you want even center left, really. I mean, the Democrats have seemed to me have just there has been this. I guess they call it the blob, and I can't remember who made that that they created that term. But that's
Barack Obama.
Was it Barack Obama who talked about the foreign policy blob?
Yep.
He certainly didn't seem to get outside of it.
Let me pick up on this, Sam. I know what you're saying. I agree. I began my straight out of college career working for the Institute for Policy Studies for a man named Richard Barnett, who was the leader, a leader of left-wing foreign policy thinking. That's what I wanted to be when I grew up. I also greatly admired a Harvard professor named Stanley Hoffman, who was considered sort of the anti-Kissinger at Harvard. And I thought, originally, I thought I was going to make my career doing the same thing. Barnett was pretty mainstream, even though he's quite left-wing. He was then the New Yorker's foreign policy writer, and people took it seriously. But you're right that the left-wing has attenuated in this position. It's basically embraced Obama's foreign policy ended up being sort of old-fashioned conservative policy. Now that the right wing has become so crazy, the old-fashioned conservatives are the liberals. There was a moment, you know, Obama, he picked his battles. And I would have picked different battles. The battle he didn't pick was taking on the foreign policy establishment until the very end of his tenure, when he talked about the blob and he got a little impatient with Israel. But when Obama ran for the Democratic nomination, he ran against this whole foreign policy establishment where we have to intervene everywhere and where military power is all we have to sell. And he accused Clinton of representing it. And at the time, I don't know how well this was known, Richard Holbrooke was running Hillary Clinton's foreign policy team. And he was telling everyone, if you work for Obama, you will not get a job in the Clinton administration, the Hillary Clinton administration of 2008. And he scared away everyone who had these ambitions, with a few exceptions, one of them being Samantha Power, and another one being a close friend of mine named Sarah Sewell, who together did most of Obama's foreign policy writing during the administration. And so a bunch of people, including some people associated with the Center for American Progress, took a risk and stuck with Obama against Hillary in the hopes of rethinking foreign policy from a liberal perspective. And Obama sold these people out when he chose Hillary Clinton to be Secretary of State. He vetoed a few of her choices. He wouldn't let her bring Sidney Blumenthal into the State Department. But basically, he said the moment, the opening he had created, he decided was not a battle he wanted to fight. And so the blob took over again. And towards the end, he tried to fight it a little bit. Ben Rhodes writes about this very well in his book. But that was a really lost opportunity. There's an article in The Nation, current issue, I believe, about my friend Matt Duss,
yes,
who is Bernie Sanders' top foreign policy advisor. And Matt, first at the Center for American Progress, where he left, I used to work with him there, because he felt uncomfortable with his Middle East policy, which he was in charge of, sort of. Then at the Foundation for Middle East Peace, and now in Bernie's office, he has been not only trying to rethink strategic ways to counter the blob, but also to come up with new concepts. And I'm critical of Sanders in a lot of ways, but this is the best thing he's done, I think, is not only challenge the precepts of the foreign policy establishment, but also try and rethink what new liberal internationalism would look like.
Eric Alterman, always a pleasure. Thanks so much for coming on, man. I really appreciate it. We're going to take a quick break in a minute and come back to speak to Isabel Gillies. Before we do, reminder, there's no quick fix when it comes to better health. It's all about starting good daily habits and actually sticking to them. Enter Ritual, the obsessively researched vitamin for women. Ritual's essentials have the nutrients most of us don't get enough from our diets, all in their purest, cleanest forms. no shady additives or ingredients that actually do more harm to your body than good. Two easy-to-take capsules provide 9 nutrients you need to build a stronger foundation for better health, all with a fresh, minty flavor. Not to mention, all of Ritual's ingredients are vegan-friendly, sugar-free, non-GMO, gluten-free, and allergen-free. A subscription is easy to start, and it's easy to snooze. It's only $1 a day to have the essential nutrients your body needs delivered every month. I, of course, am not a woman, did not take these, but sent them to one of our team of endorsers. No sugar, vegan-friendly, gluten-free is not as easy as a combo as you think. I like that the vitamins and nutrients are sourced. Basically, all the vitamins and nutrients are sourced as to where they come. You can check it out at ritual.com/majority. And I love that it's a subscription service. As many times as I've started on vitamins, I've stopped after the first bottle runs out. Better health does not happen overnight, folks. Start your year with Essential for Women, a small step that helps create a healthy foundation for 2019 and beyond. Visit ritual.com/majority to start your ritual today. That's ritual.com/majority. Let's take a quick, in light of the fact that Donald Trump is going to be declaring a national emergency. And you should understand, too, that the term national emergency is a legal term. And it is not, even though I think it's quite obvious to all of us that it is not time sensitive. There's a legal definition that does not include necessarily, would not be necessarily contradicted by the fact that Donald Trump has not found this emergency to exist in a timely fashion. There will be court cases testing whether he can do this. In fact, let's play that clip. Donald Trump previewed it. Brenda, did you send him that one? Yeah. In his announcement today. Now, some people have pointed out that Trump said, I didn't have to declare a national emergency. I just wanted to get it done quickly. That's going to come up in the court cases. That's going to come up in the court cases.
A little bit of a breadcrumb for the other side's counsel.
The real issue here
make it fair.
Is the reappropriation of money that Congress has appropriated for other things. That's what all of this is going to turn on. Donald Trump both gives a preview of where this is going to go in the courts and an argument that he probably should be subject to the 25th Amendment in this clip. Here it is.
We will have a national emergency, and we will then be sued, and they will sue us in the Ninth Circuit. Even though it shouldn't be there, and we will possibly get a bad ruling, and then we'll get another bad ruling, and then we'll end up in the Supreme Court, and hopefully we'll get a fair shake, and we'll win in the Supreme Court. Just like the ban, they sued us in the Ninth Circuit, and we lost, and then we lost in the appellate division, and then we went to the Supreme Court, and we won. And it was very interesting, because yesterday they were talking about the ban. Because we have a ban. It's very helpful.
Yeah, he doesn't talk about it. You notice how he doesn't say what it is? The ban. Because he wants to say the Muslim ban, but he knows he's not allowed to say that anymore.
Well, you can't remember what we're calling it now.
Right, exactly. And so it will ultimately end up in the Supreme Court. It probably will end up there either after Donald Trump is gone or in his second term.
Yeesh.
The interesting thing will be, I can tell you, if there's a Democrat in the presidency, when it reaches the Supreme Court, I can tell you how it's going to go. But if not, if Donald Trump, if it reaches the Supreme Court, and it's conceivable, right, that they expedite this in some fashion, and it gets to the Supreme Court, And I would be very surprised if they okayed this, but it's conceivable they would. This is really going to open up the door. I mean, the when you hear Democratic politicians now say stuff like, we're going to use we could use this for climate change. We could use this for providing health care. We could use this for, I don't know, high-speed rail, daycare.
The circuit courts, through the other courts.
Lead in pipes?
But lead in pipes. I mean, there's a whole myriad of things that they could use this for. When you hear Democratic politicians say that now, those are empty threats, in my estimation. However, if the Supreme Court actually validates this, those threats may end up getting to be a little bit less empty because the base of the party, never mind the base, frankly, huge swaths of the country will then expect the president at that time to address these things that are clearly more of an emergency than what's going on at the border. And it's going to be interesting to see where this goes. But you know, for now, it's just something for Donald Trump to, what did Ann Coulter say? To give to his idiots or something to that effect.
A serious question, though. Couldn't the Supreme Court just decide that they don't respect that precedent? Like Kavanaugh has already shown he has no respect for precedent.
So you're saying that they would okay it?
In Trump's case.
In Trump's case, and then 2 years later, not okay it?
Yeah.
I mean, theoretically, but no. I think at that point, you know, some of these guys, John Roberts in particular, at least perceives this to deal with their legacy.
But if you're someone who doesn't care about the legacy of the Supreme Court, like, make them do that, right? Like, make the if they, like, make them put their money where their mouth is, if you know what I'm saying?
No.
Like,
who's they?
The Supreme Court. Like, let's say you wanted to make the Supreme, like, reform the Supreme Court. Having them do something like allow Trump's national emergency and not allow in the future Democrats' national emergency would be a really good way of delegitimizing it.
But there's nobody who can say, do this. I just think if no one's going to make the Supreme Court do anything in that respect. I think, but my guess would be, no, it would be even beyond their capacity to rule that way and then 2 years later rule a different way.
I hope you're right. If Ruth Bader Ginsburg goes, we're going to get another Kavanaugh.
If Ruth Bader Ginsburg goes while Donald Trump is in office, then it may be a very different calculation because I think, you know, John Roberts showed in the Gee case, right? This one from Louisiana, when he voted with the four liberals, as it were,
institutional
that there was no way that he could have voted one way on the trap law in Texas and then voted the other way on the exact same law. Yes, if Ruth Bader Ginsburg is gone, it's a completely different calculation. If it becomes 6-3, and John Roberts is the fourth vote out of five, you know,
I mean, if anything, it would be a very good justification for packing the courts.
Well, of course. But these are all, we're out like four hypotheticals.
I don't know, Senator. Do you like beer? That's Ruth Bader Ginsburg,
right.
Brett Kavanaugh mashup.
We got to take a quick break. When we come
like
back,
beer.
Isabel Gillies will be joining us. We are back. Sam Seder on the Majority Report. Ladies and gentlemen, we have occasion on Fridays, sometimes far too rare, to play this magical ditty.
Today is Casual Friday. Let us welcome Isabel Gillies to the show. She's going to recommend a movie or two to watch on Netflix. It's the only way I know.
Listen to the picks from Isabel.
IsabelGillies.com.
Yes, ladies and gentlemen, the best-selling author of Happens Every Day, who's got a new book out.
It is. It's out. It is in the world.
This has been like a 2 or 3 year project.
Yeah, 2 years. Maybe even two and a half years. It was before Trump I started.
Wow, yes. It was a different era. Now it's probably Trump. Needed more than ever. And well, we should say,
who knew?
It is Cozy, The Art of Arranging Yourself in the World. And it's sort of like, I mean, is it okay for me to say it's a little bit like Marie Kondo, right?
Or it's a little, well, it's not really exactly like Marie Kondo, because Marie Kondo is kind of saying something a little different, I think. I mean, it's in the same, maybe it's in the same, it's like a dialectic almost. It's like it is, but it isn't, because... Well, what I'm saying is, maybe we're saying the same thing. Maybe we're saying the same thing. But I'm not talking about just cleaning up your house.
Right. No, but I mean, it is also about, like, how do you make yourself feel better in wherever you are on some level?
Yeah, oh, totally. It's about the truth of who you are and then bringing that to wherever you are. Because the fact is that we are in crappy circumstances a lot. Right? Like, you could be in a hospital, you could be in a, you know, war zone, you could be, I mean, there's, you can be just cold out on the street. And there are ways that you can feel okay about that if you know, like, your mojo, what makes you tick, where you come from, that kind of stuff. And then you can apply it and kind of arrange yourself around that and name it, you know. Like, I find pencils cozy, right? So if I'm in a situation where there's a whole chapter on pencils where I'm not happy, and that could be like, I was really dyslexic. Tests were really a bummer for me, but my pencil, I was really cozy to me. So I was like, all right, you know what? I have my pencils. I have to take the test. Did the pencil mean that I didn't have to take the test? No. But if I recognized that I liked pencils and they kind of make me feel good, well, then it's a little better.
It's a little bit, I mean, I want to say self-hypnosis, but it's I guess it's just basically strategies for some measure of self-care in more or less extreme situations.
Yeah, or in just everyday situations. Like, well, it all comes out of my first book. There was this, like, I was getting divorced and it was really sad and I had babies and it was really, really sad. And we were in this restaurant and they served weird pancakes. This chef was like kind of went rogue and was making pancakes that were like with, you know, leeks on them and all these kind of things. And I was like, I don't care. I'll take that. And then everyone was so sad and sick and it was just a nightmare. It was misery. And I had a bite of pancakes just because that's what was in front of me. And I was like, oh my goodness. It was like the best thing I'd ever had in my life. And I was like, I almost shrieked. I was like, oh! And in that second, I was like, oh my God, I'm alive. Like I'm not dead. Like, this isn't killing me because I think these crazy pancakes are good. And I was like, that's so amazing that I can feel that. Did it change the fact that my husband was leaving me? No. Did it change the fact that my kids were going to grow up without their father in their house? No. But it was enough to build on. So that I could step on it. It was solid enough that I could step on it and like keep going, which is the only thing you can do, right? So it's like about knowing those moments are around you and they're right under your nose. It's like low hanging fruit that you can just, if you know about it, you can just use it.
All right. Well, what about for someone like myself who does not have things like a pancake that I like?
Well, but the thing is that, first of all, I've been in your studio. Your studio is deeply cozy. There's like your desk, and I bet you have, like, there's a whole, did you read the chapter on Rachel Martin, the NPR? I talked to all kinds of people. I talked to doctors and nurses and Doctors Without Borders doctors and architects, and I talked to Rachel Martin from NPR, and she writes a lot about her studio and how cozy it is, and like the font size. If she doesn't have it the right font size, she doesn't feel right, and that's cozy. It's like, you, I bet you have a ton of stuff like that.
It's actually
that
true.
I don't know.
I will say that when we redid the studio, I don't know that it really made that much of a difference for people who were watching the show as much as it did change, I think, the feeling that we had when we were sitting either at this desk or in the producer. What do you call those horseshoes that we got there? Right. Did you feel that? Did it change? Like, I mean, there was nothing material like that significantly changed.
I feel a lot cozier in these things, definitely.
But like cozier, like
in
the in your wheelhouse, right? That's what you're talking about.
Yeah,
yes, it definitely is.
Exactly. And that will affect, actually, it will affect the way you talk about stuff. I mean, it sounds trite, but it's actually really not. It's actually, if you feel good and you feel like something, and it's not comfort. That's the thing, is that it's not comfort. I'm always uncomfortable because I'm in chronic pain because I have slipped discs. So I'm never comfortable, but I can be cozy. Like I can do things. Like, I always use this example. I love mailboxes, right? So I actually love post offices. So if I'm in a town that I don't know and I might feel a little freaked out by that, and I just see the post office, something inside me is rubbed. And I'm like, oh, hey, post office, I know you. Like, you know, and it just makes me feel better. And it's cozy.
A lot of people do that with Starbucks.
Yeah, no, totally. Starbucks does that. Mm. And actually, I started drinking coffee, and this is cozy, because I was so jealous of people's holiday cups. I was like, I just want one of those. It looks like it's cozy. It looks like people love having it.
You started drinking coffee because you wanted those paper cups?
Yeah, that's right. Mm. And a lot of it comes from, it's not about money. It's not about like aspirational, like fireplaces and cashmere socks. Because think about it. People that live in, you know, the Philippines, they don't find that cozy because that's not their climate, you know? So it's like, it's all about stuff that's either local or that comes from your history, like where you grew up, how you grew up, who you grew up with, what is it? Like, I'm Scottish, so I find things that are Scottish kind of cozy, like barley, you know? So I just know that about myself and I can use it. It's sort of utilitarian self-help.
And when did it, it just came out, right? You got, well, I'm checking this out right now.
Yeah, it came out on Tuesday. Yeah.
You got one review already. 5 stars.
Really?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah. You want me to read it to you?
People seem to be, what I like is the feedback that I'm getting is that people are like, oh, I didn't think about that. Like, I didn't think, and it's all about stuff that like, that's in their life already. So it's not like, oh, you have to go and buy something or you have to go and like be something you're not. It's the only thing you have to be is yourself, which is sort of, if that's intimidating to you, and it can be, and I address this in the book, like here I am saying you have to know yourself and that's how you're going to feel good. But what if you don't know yourself? What if you don't know what makes you tick? I sort of say you can make it up, you know? Just choose something. Be like, okay, well, I like red floors. And if that
I like red what? Fords?
Floors. Like,
oh, floors.
I'm walking on a red floor right now. But like, you could, if you saw a red floor, like a church or something, and then you're like, I like this kind of feels good. Paint your kitchen floor red. you know, then paint your garage floor red. Then just like tell your kids. But it's like then you can build on it. And then you do have something that you identify with. And then people identify that with you. They're like, oh, there's Charlie. He always has red floors.
Charlie red floor. Now, wait a second. Now, how much of the, what is that? All right, let me ask you this then. What is the little book of Higgy that they're saying?
That's called Hig.
Yeah.
That's Danish. That's not really what I have a chapter on Denmark because I went to Denmark to check out that whole thing. That's not really what my book is about because that really is about like candles in the window and that comes very much from that culture. This is sort of a little different than that. This comes from like you as opposed to, well, I guess that is too, but it's a little more than Hygge in that it is like I find the number one subway train the coziest place on earth. And
really,
you know, oh yeah, 100%, yeah.
Why is that? Because, just because you have associations with it that are good?
Well, first of all, I love a corner seat. My family were strap hangers. I grew up in New York. My family took the subway to work every day, and at night they would sit around and talk about. They'd be like, "Oh, the B train was just there right when I got on the platform. It was just waiting for me there. So awesome!" And then I got, you know, then it was a perfect transfer to the NMBR or whatever. And then I took that with me into the world. And I was in a circumstance once when a kid was having a hard time, and I had a choice. I had to get home, and I was like, "Should I take the subway or should I take a taxi?" And I was like, "You know what? I have to take the subway because it's kind of like humanity. It's like, are the people on the subway going to fix my problem? No. But being around the people in the car just kind of made me feel part of a community, for lack of a better word. It just made me feel better. And subways are cozy. It's like they rumble. They're sort of like in New York, they're kind of falling apart. So there's something about it that's like, just like, it's this huge, huge system and we get to all ride it. It's cool. I love it. It's cozy.
I mean, I like the subway. I don't know if I would ever describe it as cozy. I'm not sure I really understand the term, frankly. I mean, we've talked about it for 3 years, and I still think I haven't quite figured it out. I mean, I get this concept that you're talking about.
Read the book. You'll get it.
Of course I'm going to read the book.
It's not cozy. It's not like you're the cozy that you grew up with. It's not like the cozy like falling snow and hot chocolate. It's like a little bit of a deeper beat. It's not about physical things.
It's about hitting some chord in you that is helpful.
Yeah, and then arranging yourself in your circumstance, in your community, in your house, and I talk to designers and I talk to I talked to nurses, you know, I talked to this one nurse.
Yeah, I was just going to ask you about the hospital stay stuff because.
Yeah. Well, like my friend who had an aneurysm, she was looking at a copy of this book and she was like, "Oh my God, I'm so glad you said ICU rooms are cozy." And I was like, "Oh my goodness," because she was in an ICU room. And then the nurse I talked to had been at bedside for 40 years. She was this badass nurse. And she was like, "Oh, they're totally cozy." And then I get into it. Why? I was like, why? Because it seems like that would be not a cozy place. And she's like, no, they are. And then she calmly and like stoically told me what she thought. And it just really connected. I was like, yep, that's what I'm talking about. And it's really helpful to know because, you know, there, but by the grace of God, go I, we could be in an ICU. Any freaking day we could be in an ICU. We don't know. And if you even knowing that you can be okay by just the littlest stuff, like when I was in a hospital once and I had this cup and they had these ice cubes that were like kind of shaped like long pencil erasers and they were kind of squishy.
Wait,
and
what?
They were like these weird ice cubes and I just loved them. And it was in Boston. And I would go and like shuffle to the ice machine and get myself the ice and then I'd pour a little bit of Pepsi in it and it just felt like the coziest thing in the world. And I'd like check out the clock and like see the board where people post messages and I might say hi to the orderly. And it was just like, it made the whole thing kind of cozy. Does it make your hospital stay like not have to happen? No, it just makes it better and survivable, I guess.
I've never heard of a squeezy ice.
I think I get it.
Chewable ice.
It sounds to me like there's a social element to coziness here, right? Like, totally. You know, you're being taken care of. You're not alienated from other people. I read a little bit about this concept. Someone wrote about it in Jacobin, actually. Article by Megan Day called "You Don't Want Hygge, You Want Social Democracy." And it kind of talks about how that feeling in Denmark is enabled by the fact that, you know, it's not a socialist country, but it is a social democracy, and people are less alienated, less competitive with one another. They're more taken care of, kind of like that.
Yeah, that's true. And it's there. Well, there's a whole section on Denmark, and a lot of it is like about like noise and there, and like, it's an interesting, I mean, I went to Denmark because I liked Hamlet. So I was like, I'm not going to check out Candles. I'm going because I want to go to Elsinore. You know, that's sort of like, but
I don't know any of the things that you're talking about.
It's a play by William Shakespeare.
Wait, what? What did you
one
say?
One of his big hits.
Wait, say this.
More and
anyway,
more people are talking
is,
about
you gotta
him.
Read the Denmark chapter.
Okay.
Hello?
I will.
So why were, oh yeah, but in Denmark, well, Denmark is a very isolated place too. And so that's, I think they find there's like, it's isolated and they don't have like, their immigration's not like great. So they have a lot of the same stuff. It feels very, uniform there to me. I felt it was, and that's their version of it. I come from a place that has like a ton of immigration, and so like different things feel cozy to me than that. But it's like, it's kind of don't yuck anybody else's yum. Like they have their thing, you have your thing. That it could cross over. It could, you know, it's a big smorgasbord.
Smorgasbord. Well, Brendan just sent me Sonic Ice, that an explanation of the chewy ice, apparently.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
What? No, that couldn't be what it is. It was like an ice machine.
Yeah. Apparently it is. It's the Manitowoc QF-400 that makes Sonic
God.
Ice. Apparently this is Matthew Gahanay. Matthew McConaughey got one of those ice makers in his house because he liked it so much.
What?
Yeah.
See, I wrote a whole thing about that ice. I didn't even know it was a real thing. And that's the other thing. I always loved the X-ray blankets and found them very cozy. Well, and so I wrote about that. Guess what gets invented? A weighted blanket.
Yeah. In fact, I think I read a read for that for next week. We have one of those at, what is it, comfortblanket.com. calmingcomfort.com/majority, I think.
Oh my God. Well, it's science. It's because weight, when something's heavy on you, like fires off dopamine in your head.
There you go.
Which brings feelings of like happiness and calm.
So, what is it? Are you going to have, I assume you're going to have a book party, but.
Well, I was at the Y. I had a book talk with Mariska Hargitay at the Y on Tuesday.
I think
that was
my
fun.
Sister was going to go to that.
I sent it to you. I don't know if you were there,
you
but
did
there were
not.
A lot of people. It was like
you
500.
Did not did send so. It to me.
Oh, I did so.
I did.
I sent it to. I had to. Well, anyway, it was on. I was on. Like I posted about it and stuff.
You had a book party. You didn't invite me, didn't you?
No, it wasn't a party. You had to buy a ticket.
I'm not talking about that. I feel like you had a book party, and you're
not
telling me.
No, I didn't. I swear to God. I swear
all right.
to God, and I'm standing in a church, so.
Well, so this is pretty exciting. Now, what do you do now? You go around on, are you doing a book tour?
I'm going to Los Angeles next week, and then I'm going to D.C. on the 28th, and if anybody's in D.C., I'm going to be talking at, it's a bookstore, Kramer Bookstore, but they are under construction, so it's like this place next door. On the 28th, and then I don't know. I'm just going to let it roll, see how it goes, you know? I mean, I just put it into the world and hope it helps people, and that's it.
Now, where in L.A.?
I don't know quite yet.
Okay.
I don't have a bookstore or
Can
anything
people
yet.
Go to isabellegillies.com to find out more information on your possible tour?
Go to isabellegillies.com, and I'll post everything. And I appreciate the time to talk about it, Sam.
Isabel, I'm very excited about it. I'm going to dig into the book. I'm traveling today. I've got it in my bag. And
There's a whole section on travel.
Really? I probably should have read it before I'm actually traveling.
It's all right.
Isabel Gillies, I'm very excited that your book is out, and now you get to start on
the next one. I know. What should I write about, Sam?
Oh, it's a different era.
Or everybody send me a topic, and I'll choose.
All right, people, get
Tweet
on there.
Me a topic.
head over. We will put a link to Cozy on the website. Isabel Gillies.
Oh, thank you. Thank you.
Always a pleasure.
The pleasure is mine.
Bye,
Lots
Isabel.
Of love.
Okay, talk to you soon.
Okay, bye.
There you go, folks. Cozy. All right, let's get into this. We're going to do a Freebie Friday. We've got about 40 minutes left for the program before maybe a little bit less than that because I got to get to the airport. We will call into the phones. Our 646-257-3920 is the number. I am dialing that number as we speak.
I think we can all agree that Trump has made the Oval Office a bit more cozy.
Yes, Donald Trump has made the Oval Office a little bit more cozy. Now, of course, Barack Obama had some type of like a golf simulator, but that's my understanding. But President Trump has Trumpicized it. Now, what's amazing about the fact that this exists, in my mind, is Donald Trump is constantly playing golf, constantly. And so the idea that he would need a simulator suggests to me that he may not be doing anything else but playing golf and what we literally see him physically do. Like, so when we see him speak in public, obviously he's not playing golf at that time.
That time's allotted for?
There is a website, TrumpGolfCount.com. Is that right? It cost $87 million so far, his golf. He has played 156 times. These are daytime visits to golf clubs since inauguration, with evidence of playing golf in at least 72 visits. Out of, what are we talking about now? I guess it's been... it's been 365 times two, essentially, right?
About 700 days.
700 days. So 756 days. So at least like, what is that? 20% of the time at this point, he is playing golf. And then he's in his residence, and all that executive time, people think it's just about TV. He's probably watching TV, Fox News. But here is a sense of what the golf simulator is all about. Let's look at is this the one that they're doing? This is the full swing simulator. Is this the one that he has?
It's a non-specific.
Oh, we don't know, but this will give you a general sense of what's going on.
Hey guys, Taylor here, Golf Life, checking out Full Swing Simulators. Jordan Spieth has one of these. Jason Day has one of these. Even Tiger Woods has one of these. And now you can have one too. Come with me and play. We're going to hit some balls, play some of the gaming arcade aspects, and check it out.
Yeah, Tiger's got one.
One of the coolest things about the Full Swing Simulator is you can dial in your irons, your yardages. It gives you all the stats
Sweet.
You need.
Okay,
back,
sold.
Back angle,
buying
stretch,
it. And just your I want three of them.
A lot of us don't Can really we trade a congressional medal for a free simulator?
Wait, so we've got one in the White House, but can we get one in the executive office building as well?
There you go.
Besides playing 84,
all right,
cool
let's. That actually does look pretty cool.
Looks
but
awesome.
You sort of want your president to be like not basically spending his days like Matt would if he wasn't working here.
Yeah, that looks too active for me.
Yeah, I was going to say, golf simulator. Got interrupted on the way to the bong refill with the simulator.
Let's go to the phones.
I'd accidentally hit my bong with the golf club.
Let's see here.
Even if it's just the simulation, man, it's still really traumatic.
Let's go to the phones here. Let's see. Why are we having trouble there? Having trouble getting this thing here. I'm having trouble getting onto the phone system, it seems like. It's weird. Bear with me, folks. I don't understand what's going on here. Try and call back in. Turn on the IMs in the meantime.
Thank you. The Majority Report. Sam will be with you shortly.
Yeah, robots get feeling a little under the weather today. All right, there we go there. All right, there we go. Calling from a 407 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hey, Sam. It's Christian from West Michigan.
Hello, Christian. What's on your mind? Got to be quick today. Want to try and get a lot of people in.
Yeah, I understand. I just wanted to talk a little bit about your fellow Jews in Israel and U.S. foreign policy.
Okay.
Well, I mean, it's not meant to be anti-Semitic, but...
Yeah. Oh, all right. Anyways. Well, it's a great way to start.
Yeah,
strong call.
I'm off to a great start here. Anyways, I just... Michael was talking a little bit about I think Tuesday, about the relationship between the Emirati states and Saudi Arabia and Israel. And it just seems to me like that's kind of a match made in hell. I don't really understand how that would even be possible, considering there's a lot of Saudi citizens who join Al-Qaeda and other terrorist groups specifically to fight in Palestine. Like, I'm reading... Forever War right now.
All right, well, and, Christian, you're breaking up a little bit, but I think if the question is how does the Israeli government make common cause with the leadership of countries that have radical and extremist elements in their country, and probably at least on the periphery of their leadership. I'm thinking, there's a lot of the Saudi family is huge. It's fairly obvious. One is a lot of these countries, I mean, when you talk about Saudi Arabia, they repress a lot of their people. They also use those extremist groups in the same way, I guess. I'm trying to think of an analogy, but part of it is we pay them off so they don't come after us. And sometimes that means they they go after our enemies on some level. And in some instances, they end up blowing back. I mean, so the idea that Israel would be in talks with the leadership of some other Arab countries is not, I don't know, that shouldn't
they
be surprising at all.
They share an obsession with Iran. And that is the whole point and focus for both of them. It's obsessive. And Israel, even in Syria, if you look at how the proxy wars break down, Israel's not particularly concerned about groups like Al-Qaeda and ISIS. And bizarrely, Al-Qaeda and ISIS say, sure, they hate Israel, they say horrible things, but it's never been a central part of their strategy. They focused on the United States and local governments. And there's a long history going back to the 80s where obviously the U.S. collaborated with the Pakistanis and the Saudis with some of those far right elements of the Mujahideen. And they were more scared of the Iranians. You got to look at through everything through the filter of Iran.
I see. So, I mean, it's essentially just a security pact of sorts.
Of course.
They want a quote-unquote stable Middle East. They don't want anything to change. They want the same U.S., Saudi, Israel axis that's dominated U.S. foreign policy for decades.
Appreciate the call, Christian.
And
It was weird. All right, appreciate the call. We got to move along.
I thought I was getting like a guitar riff for that answer.
Calling from a 509 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Well, well, well. Look who's getting into the vitamin business. Gluten-free vagina pills. Bull moo, Maddow!
Jesus.
Not bad.
Oh, Sammy. Oh, they got to jump it with some kind of joke. Play the video at your little show. Everybody have a good laugh. But this is war! You mean business! Let me tell you what makes me feel cozy. I like to take my enemies and dismember them and store them in my padlocked basement freezer. Politically speaking!
Okay.
I got it.
Appreciate
that. That makes me feel cozy.
It's all coded. It's all coded.
Appreciate the phone call. I can only imagine who that was. Calling from a 630 area code. Who's this? Where are you calling from?
Hi, this is Ryan from Chicago.
Hello, Ryan from Chicago. What's on your mind?
I got two quick points. The first about the national emergency. I don't think the Dems will be able to threaten anything with this. After the courts uphold it, I don't see why the Republicans just wouldn't change the law and not allow them to do this in the future. Like, if he declares this as a national emergency, this will be the last time this national emergency bill is used the way it is.
What makes you think that the Republicans are in a position to unilaterally change the law now?
Because Democrats are decorum elementals, so that this could be abused again.
You're breaking up. We got a problem with the... What's that? Yeah, I think so. Well, I mean, look, I guess it's conceivable. It just seems highly unlikely to me that a Congress that was controlled by Democrats would, in the wake of a Supreme Court ruling in favor of the president doing this, would then turn around and pass a law, because that's what you'd have to do in Congress. You would have to pass the law that there would be enough Democrats who would pass this, I guess, in conjunction with Republicans to shut the door on this.
Well, it could be like a bipartisan two wrongs don't make a right commitment to norms kind of thing. Like, we need to make sure this doesn't happen again.
That's conceivable. But I imagine they would, if they did that in the wake of the Supreme Court finding that, then it would prevent Donald Trump from doing it, too. Right. I mean, that would be, they could make it retroactive. If the argument is that the Supreme Court could find that there is, you know, room, it's possible that they could address it in such a way. I mean, the reality is that I don't know that Donald Trump is going to get the funds, even under the auspices of what he's doing, to build any more of the wall. To the extent that he was trying to get $5 billion, he was going to get $25 billion a year ago, and nobody was worried about it in terms of actually being completed. So, because once you get past his ability to say, I'm going to reappropriate money that's been appropriated other places, then you move into the stage of everyone whose land is being taken for eminent domain is also going to go through a series of laws. So, the first question is, will he be authorized to even attempt to pretend to build the wall? And then, as he pretends to build the wall, will he actually be able to build the wall because of all the other legal challenges to it that will exist outside of whether he was authorized to reappropriate money in the first place? So, I mean, it's conceivable to me that Congress could right now pass a law that would prohibit the president from using declaring a national emergency in this way. I wouldn't be surprised if we see that in Congress now, in the House, anyways, because I think that is, I mean, I that would not surprise me.
It'd be mighty bold of them.
Well, I mean, the question is that the Supreme Court would address is whether there was constitutional authority. And I don't know that Congress can necessarily limit the president's constitutional authority. I mean, it may be worth having a legal expert on to talk about what issues would come up in this context.
A lot of legal experts, though, are really utopian. So
they're going to compromise and have some kind of border security package where there's...
Well, they did.
Yeah.
They already did.
I mean,
that.
They've expanded. Look, to the extent that they've expanded funding for ICE, they expanded and included a soft cap on the actual beds that the Customs Border Patrol can have. I don't think there's anything in particular that, from a material standpoint, is particularly good about this deal, frankly. I mean, I think from a political standpoint, there's a sense that Donald Trump lost. It may have made the Republicans more allergic to shutting down the government in the future, maybe. I don't think this deal is any great shakes in that respect. But speaking of the powers of the president to declare a national emergency, Mike Pence came out against that ability right on C-SPAN. Wonder, hope for his sake that Donald Trump doesn't see this.
Well, I think it would be a profound mistake for the president of the United States to overturn American immigration law with the stroke of a pen. Issues of this magnitude should always be resolved with the consent of the governed. Signing an executive order, giving a speech, barnstorming around the country, defending that executive order, is not leadership. And I would implore the president to reconsider this path, mm-hmm. and to demonstrate the kind of leadership that the American people long to see, and that is that this administration would sit down with this newly minted mm-hmm. Republican Congress and find genuine common ground, border security. There's a series of piece-by-piece reforms that I believe could be advanced in this Congress that would be in the long-term interest of the American people on this issue.
Now, of course, he said the newly minted Republican Congress, and that's because this was from half a dozen years ago when Barack Obama had basically, by executive order, just essentially changed the prosecutorial discretion of ICE at that time and said, we're not going to pursue DACA or DAPA, folks. And we see this prosecutorial discretion all the time. Ronald Reagan called in the other day, immigration lawyer, who said that ICE will detain people based upon the space that they have. That there is no set threshold in which they will detain somebody. It's just a function of how much space they have. So in other words, it is their prosecutorial capacity that dictates who they will round up. So that's ultimately what DACA and DAPA was all about. Now, I don't know. Donald Trump sees that he's going to care about it that much.
Oh, you thought because I was in the golf simulator, you could get... Oh, that was Obama time? Okay.
Someone should show it to him and tell him that it's from yesterday and get Mike Pence fired.
I think that would actually... I think that's honestly the reason why people dug it up and put it around. But it's not going to be on Fox.
Oh, because I'm in the simulator. You think you can go twist your mouth to talk some trash?
Here is Nancy Pelosi explaining the Democratic strategy to provide legal challenges against this declaration of the national emergency.
What's happening at the border? It's a humanitarian challenge to us. The president has tried to sell a bill of goods to American people. But putting that aside, just in terms of the president making an end run around Congress, here he said, let us respect what the committee will do, and then walks away from it. But in any event, the president is doing an end run about Congress, about the power of the purse. You've heard me say over and over again, Article 1. The legislative branch, the power of the purse, the power to declare war, many other powers listed in the Constitution, and, of course, the responsibility to have oversight. So the president is doing an end run around that.
She's right. the changing, you know, an executive order in terms of DAPA and DACA does not involve any reappropriation of funds. This is it's highly problematic just in terms of setting precedent. It is, you know, fundamentally anti-democratic, and it is for clearly something that is not an emergency.
Yeah, the crazy part is he doesn't even need to do that. Like you just said, they have a compromise. They're getting tons of money for this border security thing. They're still going to lock some kids in cages, just not all the kids. It's like
certainly most of the kids, and it's also like they rolled out the whole thing where they say we're building, you know, that we're finishing the wall. Right. They changed already from build the wall to finish the wall. Why can't they just said mission accomplished? Like
it's pure dick swinging at this point.
Ooh.
Well,
but yes.
Sorry.
That's a little inappropriate. Not cozy. Not cozy, folks.
All right. Let's talk a little bit about what happened with Amazon.
Goodbye.
Well, Amazon has said that they're not going to build their headquarter, but they're still going to expand. They're still going to add jobs in New York. They're not building another headquarter, which leads me to believe that maybe they didn't need these things. Like maybe these jobs, it's weird that you're planning to add 25,000 jobs. That seems like a lot of jobs for Amazon. Like, I don't know how many people Amazon employs. Can we look that up? Someone look that up. How many people does Amazon employ? 25,000 jobs, I would bet, is a non-contractors, not contractors, directly employ. I would imagine 25,000 is a significant number of people for them. Certainly more significant than jobs in New York City. And it's weird that they're not going to have a headquarters where they're going to fill those 25,000 jobs, right? But nevertheless, the bottom line is they were hostile to unions. They were hostile in terms of providing monies for infrastructure that they were going to change. They were hostile to a whole set of things. And this is the thing. Even if you were to believe that there was a net benefit to the Amazon headquarters, and I think that is a belief that is not necessarily founded in at least the experiences in the past. I mean, you can see it in terms of Foxconn. You can see it. All these deals rarely end up materializing in the way that they are assumed to materialize. But even if you were to believe that it was going to be a net positive, the precedent that would have been set for New York State to provide this many subsidies to such a large and already successful company when they would give no decent terms insofar as like even being neutral in terms of unions. New York City is a union city. And if you set the precedent of a company that doesn't need the subsidies is going to get the subsidies, then you have basically forfeited the city's ability in the future to rest any of these negotiating terms in any deal they get into the future. So you can't just assess the net results of the Amazon deal in isolation. And that is, I think, the fundamental mistake that people are making. Even those people who assume it would have been a net positive, which I think is a big assumption to make. But even if I grant you that it would have been a net positive, you got to start to roll in the implications of that deal for subsequent deals down the road in terms of it being a positive. And I think it's undoubtedly negative.
Well, now we know that New York City has $3 billion lying around that they could spend on things we need.
Well, I mean, this would have been over time. I mean, this theoretically would have been deductions on what these corporations would have had to pay. But yes, there's obviously flexibility for it. You don't necessarily need the next $3 billion coming in terms of corporate receipts. But here is a celebration that broke out. I think it was fairly spontaneous, right?
were many celebrations.
And this is, these are folks in Long Island City. Odd that they would be celebrating if it was going to hurt them. A lot of developers
about the
sort of
synergy between Amazon being next to a large housing project.
I love it so much. Like, I'll admit, I was a little skeptical when some of my DSA comrades were saying, we got to kill this deal. We're going to do community activism with all these community groups. And like, we think that we could make a difference. I was like, oh, well, you know, it's a noble goal, but good luck with that, guys. And you know, this just goes to show you that these tech overlords are not yet all powerful. And at least in a place like New York, we really can make a difference just by doing good old fashioned organizing.
Go vote for and organize for Nomiki Konst. I think that definitely her platform and position running a real campaign for public advocate played a small role in this, but not an insignificant one. And we need people now in leadership who are just going to oppose these things.
I think it also exposes the intentions of Amazon in coming here. Because right. if the intentions were strictly material in terms of what they needed to do for their business, in terms of specifically their operations, they wouldn't be that concerned that there was like public sentiment was jaded towards them. This is a company that fundamentally does not want to be a citizen of the community they're in. That's why they didn't even bother to look at places that really needed help, right? That's why they didn't even look at these places where they could go in and make a difference, a positive difference on day one, where perhaps getting subsidies would actually be a worthwhile thing to do in cities that were hurting. At least, at the very least, in terms of some type of tax reduction, you know, if you're in a place like Detroit, let's say, it's conceivable that it's the need and the for a city like that may be that much more acute than in New York. That the stakes for giving a subsidy to Amazon are less than they would be in this city. And so, but Amazon fundamentally does not want to do that. And so they apparently, what they wanted to do was, I think, is to be close enough to New York to have influence on the media.
Oh, of course, definitely.
They picked New York and the DC metro area. I mean, it's quite like this whole ridiculous feudal style Hunger Games national competition. I mean, I think that does underscore how grotesque it all is. I mean, it was so obvious where they wanted to go, and then they would have a bunch of pageantry. And I think even just the process of all of these cities and states prostrating themselves and begging this company, which is structurally dangerous to our economy,
and delivering them all the details about their current infrastructure.
Delivering, yes, it's a exactly. Giant info. It was like a large scale version of the scam of like, do a work assignment for us as part of an interview process. Pay me,
right?
God,
exactly.
Yeah. I read actually one factor that concerned Amazon executives was how. I'm quoting now from Twitter.com, how activists in New York broadened their attacks from the specifics of the deal to the company's practices far beyond the five boroughs on unions and working with ICE, according to two people familiar with Amazon's decision.
And Amazon, the reason why Amazon didn't say, you know what, we'll stay neutral when it comes to unions is the exact same reason why, or I should say the inverse of the reason why New York had to say no to them. Because Amazon doesn't want to create a precedent in New York that they're going to be neutral in terms of unions. They don't want to set a precedent that they're offering card check to those employees in New York who might want to unionize, because they don't want to do that in Seattle, and they don't want to do that in D.C., and they don't want to do that anywhere else that they have an outfit. And so for that same reason that Amazon understands, they understood the importance of precedence in this equation. That's why New York
had to reject it. Let's listen to Fox News on how New York is just ruined.
Oh, this is going to be good.
So you might have heard about this big contest to get a hub in your city. 200 cities competed for it. Because of that, New York City sweetened the pot. They gave tax breaks once this was built. They said you're going to love it here. They made sure that it was something that Amazon wanted to go. Because when you have a first-round draft pick or the fastest-growing company in the country, you want to do whatever it takes to get here. Now, Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez is among the high-profile politicians who staked their reputation on stopping Amazon because in her mind, she said we should use that $3 billion for other things. $3 billion in tax breaks doesn't mean you hold $3 billion. So she won. She actually believes that New York benefits by not bringing the fastest, most effective, the biggest company in the country to New York City. Listen to her.
Pause it for 1 second. Incidentally, Amazon's already here. They're in New York. I don't know how many employees they have in New York, but I think it's thousands. And they're expanding. And guess who else is expanding here in New York without any of these big subsidies? Google.
I think it's incredible. I mean, it shows that everyday Americans still have the power to organize and fight for their communities. And they can have more say in this country than the richest man in the world. We were subsidizing those jobs. So for the city was paying for those jobs. So frankly, if we were willing to give Amazon willing to give away $3 billion for this deal, we could invest those $3 billion in our district ourselves if we wanted to. We could hire out more teachers. We can fix our subways. We can put a lot of people to work for that money if we wanted to.
There's an expression, you got to spend money to make money.
It was $25 to $30 billion over the next 20 years. So what's $3 billion in tax breaks?
Do you know what that company would have done as it spread out? And also with the tax sector,
would have been attracted. Every state is fighting for Amazon.
Mark Thiessen.
Oh, my God.
Well, I also just, I mean, again, this makes zero difference. But I do recall having arguments with your ilk about you spend money to make money. That's interesting when it only applies to giving a break to a giant predatory corporation.
But right.
General principle? Yeah. Word.
Right.
Word up.
Also, with he made a mention about when you got a great draft pick. Like, you don't get to bid on draft picks. The team with the worst records gets to select those. So maybe we should have let, like, I don't know.
Detroit.
Yeah.
Detroit.
It's trickle-down economics, Carolina. Pure and simple. They just keep trying to sell it in a new package, and it's ridiculous and sad.
Super sad, but they're really up in arms about
it. I love the sour grapes from everyone. It's hilarious.
Newark, New Jersey says, please bring it here. We need it. I understand it. Hey, listen, you have to understand something. Amazon's a first-round draft pick. You pay a lot for first-round draft picks and high-profile free agents. There's no difference. You have to make this good for Amazon.
All right.
He's so bummed. You know what that sounds like to me? That sounds like Kilmeade bought some property in Long Island City. Incidentally, I had pulled this the other day when they were threatening it. I just looked. Local real estate folks were saying that if Amazon does, after they were threatening, if Amazon does pull out, this will be good for the folks who live in the neighborhood. If they pull out. And some of the big losers, of course, are those
real estate speculators.
Yeah.
Boo-hoo.
I mean, I think they're probably going to win anyways. I mean, that's the thing, is that I can guarantee you those Amazon executives who bought the property when they knew that Amazon was going to do this and it wasn't public, they're going to hold on to that property. And instead of maybe making, 75% returns in a 2 or 3 year period, they're just going to make like the normal 15 to 20% return year over year that you make on New York real estate. And there's no doubt in that area, there's going to be other companies that come into those areas. They're not going to have the same monopolistic power as Amazon. If they want those subsidies and they want it aggregated in that way, they're going to have to give something to the city, and that's going to ultimately be better. But here is
please tell me this is some real estate jackass whining.
This is a local business.
Thank God, this guy looks like such a schmuckle.
Here we go.
I'm not going anywhere. I'm inviting more people to come down here and tell you what's up. This street is garbage, and it's probably partly your fault. Oh, okay, Ryder truck parking lot? Is that what we're... That's the best we're going to do around here is a Ryder truck parking lot. We're a goddamn embarrassment to New York City now because of you guys. Happy?
Wow. Well, actually, I am.
I mean, we're going to...
I'm even happier
should,
now.
And I think you should treat Ryder Company with a little bit more respect. They actually provide a lot of jobs.
I mean, the bottom line is going to be we're going to see if how New Yorkers react to this. And this is going to be a much more democratic process than it was set up by de Blasio and Cuomo in the first place. I mean, that was what was problematic. Is this was just fundamentally not a democratic process. They did this behind closed doors. They sprang it on people. They did not realize what the community expected in terms of returns for giving the one of the wealthiest individuals in the world this kind of tax break.
I also think, and this is just politics, when Bloomberg came out and, you know, not for any deep justice reasons, obviously, because Bloomberg is almost like an avatar of the problem in New York City. But when he basically was like, I don't think they need those tax subsidies, I think that like the way people are going to react to it has been pretty strongly set. Like the people who opposed the deal were all over it really quickly. And you could tell, like, of course, de Blasio and Cuomo were wrong on the merits, but particularly like, and Cuomo doesn't care. I mean, Cuomo's actively hostile to this position, but de Blasio obviously fancies himself as part of the progressive movement. And he is in some ways, but I mean, he was just could have not have been more flat footed. It's like, dude, you're a couple years out of date and it's moving real fast.
Oh, yeah. Cuomo is promising reprisals, which I have no doubt that he will deliver because he's a vindictive asshole. De Blasio is trying to pretend like he's on the community side now. So they're both being very characteristically themselves. I also like how quick they are to blame it on local socialists as if, you know, you can still do the Red Scare on people.
Well, sure, you could still do the Red Scare, but let's just say, like, yes, I will take credit. We killed it. Thank you. We have a lot of power.
It's good PR.
All right. I got time for one more call. 347. I think this is in the hood. Hello. Call from a 347. Who's this?
Yeah. This is Ali from Astoria.
That's what I thought. Okay. What's going on, Ali?
I just want to throw a shout out to all the organizations and people that successfully stopped this from happening. I only spent a couple hours canvassing myself, but there have been people at this since November of last year for months. CAV, Justice for All, Make the Road. Also, I'd like to talk about the people in the neighborhood who, to an individual, expressed confusion and anger at Amazon just barreling their way in there.
Well, appreciate the call, Ali. Thank you.
Yeah.
Right.
Oh, one other thing. If anybody feels sad about politics, by Trump or whatever, go out there, do some good. You feel so much better.
Yes.
It's true. You know, we may or may not be able to avoid hell world, but at least we can say we tried.
All right, folks, I'm sorry. That's all the time we have for phone calls. I'm going to read a bunch of IMs and then get out of here. I got to take a flight. How funny it'll be to see the mental gymnastics, says Jeffrey, that constitutional conservatives will need to perform to say Trump has the power. It really forces their hand. New York has always given tax benefits to companies located in the state. People only cared about this because it was Amazon. That's correct. But I would say two things about that. One, a lot of people have said it's problematic to the extent that Andrew Cuomo shifted the burden of taxes away from corporations. That was actually one of the reasons why people were running against him so hard over the past two cycles. And two, that it was Amazon has a material difference to the precedent that's being set. When you have the richest company in the world or the richest man in the world getting tax subsidies, who then do you have leverage over in the future to provide those tax subsidies to?
I'm not opposed to tax subsidies for like mid-sized companies small businesses.
Like, it's good to oppose it on the basis that it's Amazon because Jeff Bezos wants to be your neo-feudalist lord and he's not going to stop until he gets what he wants.
Hey, Sam. Gabe, formerly from Chicago. As an ISO member, I just wanted to thank Comrade Jamie for a shout-out to WeAreMany.org the other day. Make sure she knows that the registration for the Socialism 2019 conference is now open.
Ooh, I had a wonderful time last year.
Wisconsinite, national emergency declarations are totally cozy. Gigi, got a nice cozy reefer cake song for you to play out the show dedicated to Brooksy. A Square, Sam, thanks for covering this today. And with Alterman, very courageous indeed for Oman to question a war criminal. Much respect to her. She was perfect foe for Abrams for many reasons. These women are now in Congress, fearless. Majority enjoy the week off. Thank you, A Square. Barack Bonga, snuff films make Sam cozy. Kentucky Fried Comrade, question for Jamie. Is the Russian Netflix Leather Daddy Trotsky miniseries worth watching?
Absolutely.
There you go.
It's amazing.
Congressional baseball fan. Much love to the whole MR crew. I've been going through a lot, starting a new job and having to tolerate a lot of censure of conservative and capitalist ideas. You all help me stay sane every day. And lastly, my baseball economic update. Unemployment claims are up. Retail sales and the producer price index are down. The Fed's insistence on raising rates to protect against the supposedly overheating economy is not the story told by the numbers. There was a report the other day that more people were in arrears on their car payments than we've seen in maybe it's a record. And that is a bad sign. Ian in Baltimore, the chewy ice at the NICU was literally the best part of my daughter's stay. Interesting. Glass-Steagall. Morning Joe went maniacally after AOC this morning. The cruise was she didn't know what she's talking about to learn basic economics. Maybe you can find a clip and respond. Have to wait till next week. West Coast comrade Gilly is just Judy Gold in an alternate universe where Trump is in prison and Bernie is president. Deep Fried Global. Any thoughts on David Pakman as of late? I like him, but he's made some bad videos about Ilhan Omar is anti-Semitic and Maduro is so bad we should support the opposition. Well, I haven't seen them, but I disagree with both those. Well, I mean, I think Maduro is not so great, but we shouldn't support a coup. Hi, folks and fellow Goyim. Hope you have a nice holiday. Thought I was listening to WNYC's Radio Lab for a minute. Anyway, can you explain why the terms anti-Zionist and pro-Semitic aren't thrown around as Zionist and anti-Semitic? I can't follow that. Contagious Chameleon.
I'm pro-Semitic.
This reminds me that the makers of Cards Against Humanity bought land on the border over a year ago to interfere with the wall. Oh, good for them. Wolverine, screw golf. Let's tear all courses down and build housing for the homeless. Indeed. Gulag Greg, let's gamble the thought of an unadventured outcome in terms of climate change. I think I recommended Bill Nye on climate change a few years ago, but it's a fantastic book. Pretty good for the average reader to grasp. And there's a few more in-depth chapters on thermodynamics you can skip if it's too much. JJ Cool, thanks a lot, MR. I was blocked by the Straka guy after one tweet offering advice to watch out for apathetic steamrollers. JJ the Seaplane, hey guys, and Matt, remember me, good times. Also, 3 hours, just posted self-hate video on the marketplace of ideas. Hopefully, after your first of many breaks, this kind of video make another dunk. Oh, wow, okay. Do you see, Sammy, the way you spoke about Amazon, it seems like you were the opinion it could do good somewhere with the exact same practices that got them out of New York. Wouldn't those practices and doing the exact same thing they're doing in which create negative income outcomes when they come? I'm saying the dynamic between New York City and the precedents it would set were problematic. I don't know if it would necessarily help Detroit more than New York, but almost definitionally it would.
As separate from the bigger problem of what it is as a company.
Right. Yes.
Hold multiple thoughts in your head at once.
Exactly. Christo, does Brandon Straka live within borders of New York 14 to challenge AOC? It's my district. I'm in Jackson Heights. I'm presuming he'd be relocated. I have no idea. Local Piz historian, happy Lula Teens Day. Thank Coot next. Hugo Ball, too. I imagine efforts to save Greenwich Village from freeways were dismissed by Robert Moses and his supplicants as well. Sam's Tinder profile. Hey, girl, just swipe right. Nick from Manitoba. Hey, Sam, let's hear your best Jimmy Stewart impression. Lulu. I used to be able to do one that was supposed to be Sean Connery, but it ended up sounding sorry. Like
can
Jimmy
I just
Stewart.
Let really just shoehorn in? We're doing TMBS tonight, 7. We're
okay.
Live.
TMBS tonight, 7. All right, Matt and the BK, final IM of the day. Wanted to add this about film guys' comments. I can't help but recall convincing my grandmother to take The Jerk when I was 13, my first ever R film. I loved it. I think my grandma was a bit shocked. Fun to hear Fox idiots bemoaning something that would have benefited Bezos at Nujad. Sadly, more Trump fans than I am used to. Okay, folks. See you in a week. Don't forget, there'll be new TMBS, new The Intifada, and new literary hangovers for you to enjoy. We've got some great interviews pre-recorded for next week, so check them out. I promise you, you will not be disappointed. See you in a week live, unless maybe I'll hop on YouTube if something big happens in between now and then.
Hi, YouTube.
Oh, and check out our Instagram page. I think I'm going to be in justcoffee.coop tomorrow, and I will try and do a live stream if I can figure out how to do it. Bye-bye. It might take all the strength I got to get to where I want, but I know somehow I'm going to get there. I wasn't looking when I just got caught between the truth and the light bulb. Finding out won't make me feel any better. Yeah, I know the clock is ticking, but the meds are gonna kick in, and my pilot light shining bright. I guess I'm where the choice is made, for the option where you don't get paid, for the road that finally breaks you. I guess somehow I lost my